This presentation on apologetics and worldview by Dr. Paul Hennebury of TELUS Theological Ministries is offered for the edification of all students of God's Word by spiritandtruth.org. It is our prayer that this presentation will deepen your understanding of the Bible, resulting in an improved ability to share your faith with others. Now let's begin our time with Dr. Hennebury.
Talking about, I was saying that Thomas Kuhn, for example, in his book The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, many years ago, it was published in 1962, he said that, look, you've got to, if you want to do science, you've got to fit in within the prevailing parameters that is allowable, the things that they say you should study, the way you should be studying. Otherwise, you don't get the grants, you don't get the appointments, you don't get published, and you're not part of the fraternity. And we'll start off by looking a little bit at that. I want to begin with this book called Science is a Sacred Cow by Anthony Standen, who was a chemist, I believe. Trained at, I know it was Cambridge, and also I think Caltech or somewhere like that. But he just got fed up with the way that scientists present themselves as being completely objective. And I spent some of the last 2 weeks talking about the fallacy of objectivity. Nobody is completely objective, neither can you be objective completely. Neither should you be objective completely. Doesn't mean objective truth doesn't exist. It does. In the Christian worldview, there's such a thing as objective truth, and you ought to believe it, and you ought to search for it and find it, because it's out there. Atheistic worldview, there's no reason to search for it, because atheism doesn't produce anything that's true, apart from, of course, atheism must be true. It's circular logic of naturalism. But if naturalism is true, as we saw from Alvin Plantinga last week, then naturalism can't be true, because of the evolutionary argument for naturalism destroys naturalism. Evolution does not need truth-recognizing properties in order to propagate the species. If it doesn't need it, then there's no reason to think that it has it, particularly if, as we saw from Daniel Dennett, all there is the firing of neurons in your brain, and that's what it is. You dance to the tune of your DNA, as Richard Dawkins once said. If that's true, you think the way you think because of the laws of physics and chemistry that are going on in your physical brain. That's it. Your point of view is not actually your point of view. It's just the point of view that you happen to have because of the firing of your synapses. Do you see? If that's true, there's no reason to believe it's true, because there's no truth-producing or recognizing mechanism within that scenario. But Standen here says this in his book, and I'm just going to give you a couple of what I thought were kind of interesting quotes. He says here, "Thus the world is divided into scientists who practice the art of infallibility and non-scientists, sometimes contemptuously called laymen, who are taken in by it. The laymen see the prodigious things that science has done, and they are impressed and overawed. Einstein said that matter could be converted into energy, and the atomic scientists went ahead and did it with the atom bomb." And he goes on and talks about all of these things that science has done. And then he quotes a book by somebody reporting on science, quote, "The scientist is a man of integrity and faith who trusts the basic laws of nature and intelligence to lead him into the paths of truth. His loyalty to truth is unquestioned. His capacity for patient and sacrificial inquiry is limited only by his powers of endurance. His devotion to the scientific method is unwavering. His objective is the welfare of mankind, and his discoveries, whether of medicine, mechanics, psychology, or whatnot, are the free possession of democratic peoples. Da, da, da. This is the opinion of Mr. Stuart Cole in Liberal Education in a Democracy, and is probably a fair sample of what many laymen suppose to be true, although if scientists had to be all that Mr. Cole has led to believe, there would be very few scientists. Later on he says this, the scientists are convinced that they, as scientists, possess a number of very admirable human qualities, such as accuracy, observation, reasoning power, intellectual curiosity, tolerance, and even humility. Furthermore, they suppose that these qualities can be imparted to other people to a certain extent by teaching them science. In science teachers, therefore, the natural arrogance of science, of scientists, collective arrogance, be it said once and for all, is enhanced, for they think of teaching as preaching. They expound their subject in a spirit of high missionary zeal, hoping that some of the virtues, which they believe to be theirs, will seep into their pupils by osmosis. Teachers are therefore the propagandists, the front men of science. And we can find out most easily what science is really like by paying close attention to what the scientists teach and the reasons they give for teaching it. And it continues. He then goes on and quotes another book, The Survey of Elementary Physics, that says this, quote, listen, the success of the scientific method is based entirely upon an absolute honesty of mind and love of truth. This is what Professor Hendren of the University of Georgia, Athens, Georgia, has to say, and is one of the reasons why one should read his book on physics. Quote, dogmatic prejudice, lying, falsification of facts and data, and willful fallacious reasoning are all out of harmony with the spirit of the sciences. It is writ large in the history of science that the most heinous offense a man can commit is to falsify his data and let his prejudice and his desires color his reasoning. It has never been given to such a type of mind to discover any of the important truths of nature. If a student leaves his course in physical science with the typical scientific point of view, he has obtained a moral value which will be a distinct asset and which will help him to be a happy, to lead a happy and successful life. End quote. Do you believe that about scientists? Yeah, you don a lab coat and all of a sudden you become Superman. All of a sudden, you are not vulnerable to all of the different things that we're vulnerable to as kind of lesser human beings. Things like prejudice. Things like pride. A willingness to see certain things, but not other things. This is absolute baloney. It's absolute rubbish. And it has been portrayed by the media and by scientists themselves as what they're like. So people believe there's some kind of higher priesthood of secularism. They're nothing of the sort. And as I've already said and will say again, these scientists can be very good at doing their particular discipline, microbiology, or, you know, physics or chemistry and all of the different things that they do, and be extremely bad philosophers. In fact, most of them are really, really bad philosophers. And I quoted Anthony Flew, who was a world-famous atheistic philosopher, who said that, look, when they're talking about the dissection of something, when they're talking about their particular issue, they're doing science. When they're talking about what that means, they're not doing science anymore. They're doing what I do. They're doing philosophy. The trouble is, they don't think they're doing philosophy because they're really bad philosophers. They think they're still doing science. So when, like I said, Neil deGrasse Tyson says on Cosmos, all we are is space dust, that's not a scientific statement. That's a metaphysical statement. Okay? There's no evidence that we are space dust. That's part of a theory of naturalism that is brought into science. But they haven't proved that we're space dust. They haven't proved that we evolved from anything. They haven't proved that the world is 4.7 billion years old. They haven't proved an awful lot of what they say they've proved. They've certainly not proved that you can only examine the natural world using naturalistic presuppositions. Obviously, you can only examine the natural world through natural means, yes? But that doesn't mean you have to adopt a naturalistic philosophy, which says that we're only going to allow naturalistic explanations. We're not going to allow any other explanations. That's not a scientific approach. That is an exclusionary approach based on a philosophy of naturalism. Okay. Yes, I will let you say something.
I don't know if you read the local paper, but recently there was an article about a group of people in Fort Bragg that are putting together a orca skeleton.
Uh-huh.
And one of the scientists is holding up this bone that's about that big and saying, this is a hip bone of this killer whale, which proves that it used to roam around on the earth.
No, it proves that it's a hip bone of an orca. That's what it proves. That's called homology, by the way. And we may get into little bits of homology. Some of this stuff goes into that. Folks, again, it's the naturalistic paradigm. If I put a chair up here, okay, it has a flat surface, it has legs, okay, it does certain particular things, okay? And the table has got legs too, and it has flat surface, okay? Doesn't mean that chairs came from tables. What does it mean?
They have similar traits.
They have similar traits. Why do they have similar traits? Because they're created by somebody who says, hey, I need something with legs. I need something that does this. That's ridiculous. The observation is that this bone is a hip bone and it might look like hip bones on land creatures. That doesn't mean it came from a land creature or the land creature came from that. It just means they have the same bone. That's the evidence. What you do with the evidence, how you interpret the evidence, is going to be based on what? Your worldview is going to be based on what you will allow as an explanation and what you won't allow as an explanation. Do you see? Here's Michael Polanyi again. Again, Polanyi was a world-famous chemist and then became a professor of philosophy. Where was he? Fellow of the Royal Society of England, professor of physical chemistry and social studies at the University of Manchester, and a fellow of Merton College, Oxford. And we've already seen some of his stuff and dealt quite a lot with his theory of knowledge, which I believe is the right, correct theory of knowledge. And this book, Science, Faith, and Society, he says this. In just a few places, I just want to bring this to your attention, okay? He says, for example, the premises of science on which all scientific teaching and research rest are the beliefs held by scientists on the general nature of things. The influence of these premises on the pursuit of discovery is great and indispensable. They indicate to scientists the kind of questions which seem reasonable and interesting to explore, the kind of conceptions and relations that should be upheld as possible, even when some evidence seems to contradict them, or that, on the contrary, should be rejected as unlikely, even though there was evidence which would favor them. He's saying that, quote, it's an art. It's an art. It's a skill. And he says he must recognize, that is the scientist, as authoritative, the art which he wishes to learn and those of whom he would learn it. Unless he presumes that the substance and method of science are fundamentally sound, that's an assumption, he will never develop a sense of scientific value and acquire the skill of scientific inquiry. And remember I said, unless you believe that it's worth doing science, you won't do it. So if you're a Hindu, why would you do science? Because Hindus believe, and I forgot to bring that book, Houston Smith's World Religions, but Hindus believe that all is one. Which means the thing you'd be observing is really one with you. So why would you want to study it? Because it's, you'd be denying your worldview, wouldn't you, by doing that? Do you see? If you were, again, if you were a naturalist, why would you believe that your senses report the outside world correctly? Why would you do science? I mean, evolution is just about propagating the race, is it? Isn't it? If you believe in the creation mandate, which Boyle did, and Galileo did, and Newton did, and Faraday did, and, you know, so many others, Maxwell and so on, if you believe that, then you go out and do science. You see? So he's saying here that you've got to see that it's worth doing. Unless he presumes that the substance and method of science are fundamentally sound, he will never develop a sense of scientific value and acquire the skill of scientific inquiry. This is the way of acquiring knowledge, which the Christian church fathers, he wasn't a Christian when he wrote this, described as fides querens intellectum, to believe in order to know. And I haven't done faith and reason yet, but I'm starting to introduce that. You have to believe something in order to know it. You don't just know, you don't know it and then believe it. Okay? I know that's the way that's been presented, but you don't. You have to believe something in order to know it. And then just later on, one more little quote here, which I think is worth bringing to your attention. Page 48. Paul Lanyu says, but the appointments to the posts granting this privilege, the privilege of being a scientist and doing research, must be controlled the more rigorously. The selection of scientific personnel depends largely on the value attached by scientific opinion to the different candidates' published work, in addition to which the advice of authoritative scientists is solicited in connection with every important scientific appointment. The allocation of special research grants and the conferment of scientific degrees and distinctions is conducted on similar lines. Well, if you're vying for grant money, if your appointment is based on you being in good cahoots with your superiors, do you think that you would be exactly the same as everybody else in the business world and you would toe the line? Of course you would. Of course you would. Otherwise you wouldn't write the books. Otherwise you wouldn't get the appointment. Otherwise you wouldn't get the grant. That's the way the world works. It works that way in science. In fact, it particularly works that way in science, where there's a huge amount of money involved in research projects, certain research projects. I don't want to get, since you brought it up, I don't want to get into this too much. The data's out there. particularly in history books. But as I've said, if you are a scientist and you say everything's okay and humans are not really contributing to global warming, and really there's no evidence of global warming, there is evidence of climate change, but that's different. But there's no evidence of global warming. Are you going to get a research grant? No. Are you going to get a preferment? No. If you're, would you get tenure? Absolutely not. Would you get published by the major publishing houses? No, you wouldn't. Would you get peer-reviewed articles in Nature and Science, Scientific American? No, you wouldn't. Because of what the reigning paradigm is, okay? Please don't think that scientists are any different than anybody else. In fact, many of them have got more of an issue with certain beliefs than the average American. Many of them, particularly biologists, tend to be atheists. Interestingly, many physicists tend to be theists. So, do you think that's going to color some of their views? Of course it is. Now, I make this point just so that we understand again that we are, just because a scientist says it on a scientific program or a scientific book, doesn't mean, A, he knows what he's talking about, unless he's talking about his particular area of expertise, or that he certainly that he's a man of integrity or woman of integrity. Doesn't mean that at all. In fact, many of them are there because they're politicians. They're very good at media relations. Here's Francis Crick, co-discoverer of DNA, or the double helix. He says, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but evolved. Why must they? Why? I mean, if they're biologists, they're doing science, what does it matter? Really? I mean, if it's designed, don't you study things that are designed too? I mean, certain scientists, information scientists, for example, they study, well, you're an engineer. There are engineers here. They have to study stuff that's designed, but there's science involved in it. So whether it's designed or not designed, why should that have anything to do with the way you do science? Do you see? But you see, because he's an atheist. He's a materialistic naturalist who believes you can only study nature through, the answer is, it must be a natural cause. No design. It must be goalless. It must be purposeless. It must be accidental. Okay? So that's what he's saying. If that was the case, Isaac Newton wouldn't have done any of his science. Robert Boyle wouldn't have done any of his work with gases. Michael Faraday wouldn't have done any of his public experiments. Got my glasses on, upside down. Wolfgang Smith, in his book Cosmos and Transcendence, and he's a former MIT professor, says, quote, the physical universe is viewed as the objective reality itself. That's in modern science. Right or wrong, let it be said at once that this reduction of the world to the categories of physics is not a scientific discovery, as many believe, but a metaphysical assumption that has been built into the theory at the outset. This is the book, and he says on pages 93 and 94, in short, there are means of doing otherwise, but they have been ruled out of court. Moreover, there is a traditional Christian doctrine concerning the origin of living forms which accords both with reason and with the facts. The hitch is that it accords not with the modern bent of mind, the spirit of the age, which will not let itself be trifled with. And I'm giving, again, a lot of emphasis to these things, because when you leave this course, or for those of you just here for one class, you know, I think it's really important that you don't feel intimidated by science. Okay? You need to tell yourself, first of all, the spokesman for science are the spokesman for a particular form of naturalistic science. There's an agenda, and they're part of the club. Okay? They are where they are because, you know, they're part of the club. The people who do very good science, but who are called creationists, like this guy is called a creationist. He's an agnostic. You know that the name calling is happening because they don't want to read this stuff. They don't want to interact with it. And in fact, most of the time, they will even review books. So this book, for example, Darwin's Doubt, this book was reviewed by many evolutionists like Jerry Coyne and so on. He didn't even read the book. He didn't even read the book. Some scientist. This is a book by a physicist, Stephen Barr, of the University of Delaware. And I'm sorry for just giving you all this stuff, but I'm trying to set you up. I'm trying to just kind of soak your minds in stuff so we can get on to kind of the main part here. This is a book, Modern Physics and Ancient Faith. He's a theistic evolutionist, so I don't believe in that. I don't believe that God used evolution. That would be a really stupid thing to do. A very, very wasteful thing to do, and I don't think God is a wasteful God. Anyway, he says here on page 14 of his book, the misconception that faith is opposed to rational inquiry seems to have a lot to do with the word mystery. In the writings of materialists, that's again naturalists, people that believe all there is matter and motion, as we shall see later, the words mystery, mystery mongering, and mysterianism crop up repeatedly as bugaboos to be avoided at all costs. Dogmas do not shut off thought like a wall. Rather, they open to the mind vistas that are too deep and broad for our vision. A mystery is what cannot be seen, not because there is a barrier across our field of vision, but because the horizon is far away. It is a statement not of limits, but of limitlessness. And he says a religious mystery is not a statement that reality is in itself unintelligible. On the contrary, belief in God is bound up with the idea that reality is completely rational and intelligible. Folks, that is so important. If you believe that God made this stuff and God made you, then you would believe that the order and the rationality and the beauty in the world is there, not by accident, and that you can recognize it by accident, but because it was planned. The scientist knows that there is some insight, some act of understanding which he currently lacks, which would satisfy the rational mind on the particular point he is investigating. The religious believer's faith is an extension of this attitude. He knows that there is some insight, some act of understanding that would constitute complete intellectual satiety, that is, satisfaction, because it would be a state of complete understanding of reality. What he's saying here is that when the scientist is doing his science and he's, you know, he's committedly trying to find out the truth, that's exactly the same form of knowledge as when we're trying to find out more about reality ourselves. Who are we, you know? How did God do this? Why did God put that there? It's the same form of knowledge. And then you'll be glad to hear, this is the last quotation for a while, at least from these. He says this. The philosopher David Chalmers, in his book The Conscious Mind, summarizes the various materialist approaches to the problem. That is, of consciousness and so on. One is what he calls don't have a clue materialism, which he defines as the following view. Quote, I don't have a clue about consciousness. It seems utterly mysterious to me, but it must be physical as materialism must be true. End quote. It must be true because, it must be physical because materialism must be true. Is that good philosophy? Is that good logical thinking? That's circular thinking. Circular reasoning. They do this all the time. There must be a naturalistic explanation for the world. There must be a naturalistic explanation for your consciousness. There must be a naturalistic explanation for how you got here. Why? Why must there be? And when it says naturalistic, it means unguided chance. Why must there be? Well, because all we have are naturalistic explanations. Well, hold on. Where'd you get that from? Do you see? That's prejudicing your experiments. It's prejudicing what you will and will not look at. What you will and will not think about. In fact, it's getting to the point, as we will see, where they will accept the most preposterous things rather than admit that there's a God.
Or that they don't know.
No, they will say they don't know, but they will say they don't know within a naturalistic paradigm. There must be a naturalistic explanation for this. This would be a good idea, I think, to hand around this little picture. I'm not quoting from this book. It's a great book, Darwin's Black Box. I'm just going to show you a picture, and I don't have a big picture of it. This is a picture of a bacterial flagellum. And he writes about this in his book. This thing is, I think it was, if it would be on the page, well, you wouldn't be able to see it. If you could get one and put one on the page, you wouldn't be able to see it. You have to magnify something like 50,000 times to see this thing with an electron microscope. Okay? But pass it around, have a look at it. There must be a naturalistic explanation for that. It has 40 parts to it. All of the parts need to be put together in sequence for it to work. All of the parts have to be there for it to work. The same with, by the way, everything, you know? Everything has to be put together in the right way, otherwise it won't work. You know that. If you're building something, you leave something out, it won't work. You know, it's incomplete. Especially when you're talking about very, very complex systems like this. And these are things that, until just a few years ago, we didn't even know these things existed because they were so small. If you just pass that around, Dick, so people can see that picture. Barr continues. He says, as we examine some of the arguments of materialism later, we shall see that ultimately all of them are completely circular. They all seem to boil down in the end to materialism is true because materialism must be true. later on he's saying that anything that stands in the way of materialism is ignored or denied. And that's true. That's true. Science didn't begin as being materialistic. In fact, it couldn't begin by being materialistic, just purely naturalistic. Only in a Christian worldview do you believe, you have a philosophy of realism, that you can interact with the world as it really is. You see it as it really is. I mean, obviously, as we've been designed to see it and interact with it. So pass that that around and so on. And I want to do something now, and I'm sorry for dropping this on you, but it's because I have a great deal of confidence here, which may be misapplied, but I don't think it will be. If you two don't mind just coming up here, okay? And it's all right. I'm not going to drop you in it or anything. So you guys work, you work with, what is it that you make and that you design?
Exhaust systems.
Okay? Okay, so could you just explain, and maybe you can use that if you want, how you design an exhaust system? Just briefly.
Well, first there's a requirement from the customer. So the customer has a requirement.
Okay.
So they will give us a specification or a list of wants, and then
say that you were the customer. Say that you were doing this for yourself. So you were the customer. So we'll cut out it coming to you, and you're actually designing it for you. So how do you do it? So how do you get your specifications?
I don't know. What am I designing? I have a need for something to take gas and put it somewhere else.
Okay, so you have a need.
Yes.
Okay. What other needs?
Tasks to happen.
So certain things have to happen, okay? So we'll put that. There are certain functions. Can I put that?
Yeah.
That have to happen?
No, that they want to happen.
Okay, but you want to happen, okay? Okay. So we'll just say should happen.
Engineers' jobs are just solving problems made by other engineers.
Yeah, I understand. Again, we're not trying to... I'm just trying to get some basic stuff here, and then you'll see what I do with it. Okay, so there are certain functions, okay? Where do you get these functions from? Where do you get these ideas of function?
There's a problem that needs to be
solved. So there's a problem, okay?
There's already an existing problem.
There are problems, okay? And you solve them how?
By using... existing means, so existing knowledge.
So knowledge, okay.
Okay, knowledge
and materials. Okay, just what else needs to be put here?
Usually there's some type of prototype.
Yeah, trial.
Trials. Okay, to make sure that it works, okay? Okay, so, yeah, I understand. It doesn't have to be. So this involves a purpose, yeah? Sorry. Because you're clearly planning, testing, you're purposing.
Correct.
You have goals in mind and so on. And is there anything else that you want to add to that?
Sometimes you have to redesign it if the trials don't work out.
Okay. What are you looking for as far as the function of it is concerned? Do you just want it to put it together and, you know, it just coughs and sputters and...
No, I mean, it's got to last for a long time. It's got to...
So So, okay.
In our field, it has to be light, cost effective, and on time.
Oh, okay. Well, so so it needs to be efficient and needs to be cost effective. Well, how do you make it cost effective?
By going to use the known materials and knowledge and processes that are available to you and utilizing those.
Okay. And making sure that in doing that, you are not being wasteful, and you are taking a course and making decisions all the time which are going to cut out an awful lot of expense. Yeah, okay. Is there anything else you want to add to this?
You only do this for an overall goal of solving
a problem. An overall goal. Thank you very much. That's what I was looking for. All right. An overall goal. Thank you. All right. Thanks a lot, guys. I know. Look, I'm talking out of my ignorance. So I was asking ignorant questions, but I was trying to get just them to answer certain ways that they would answer. Okay? So that means if it's going to work the way it should work, you have to design how? From the top down. I need this, and it needs to do this, and therefore I need these things which go together in this certain way in order to achieve what I want them to achieve. Do you see? You do that with bridges. You build bridges that way. You don't just start, you know, piling one thing on top of another. You try and design the bridge. It's the same with everything. You design from the top down. If you don't design from the top down, if you don't have a plan, what do you get? Waste. You get an awful lot of time. And very often, actually, you don't get anything. You just get a mess. What's that? Well, you just get a mess. It doesn't matter how much time. Okay? You actually just get a mess. You need a plan. Now, that... did that go all the way around? Okay. Can you see how complex that thing is? You know that little spinneret thing? That turns 100,000 RPM. Okay. 100,000 RPM a minute, and then it can stop on a dime at a quarter turn and then turn around the other way to direct it the other way at 100,000 RPM. How do you come to that? And by the way, this interacts with all these other things. Do you see? We looked at the kinesin. Remember? That thing that hauls molecules from one part of the cell to another part of the cell. It walks on feet. This is not accidental, folks. And people are, because they're beginning to see these things now, they're saying this has to be designed. And in fact, they are now having to learn design and engineering in order to even understand these things. And yet, some of them are still denying that they're designed. Why? Because it's got to be a naturalistic explanation. Do you see? But sooner or later, I mean, that's going to burst out of the paper bag. It's not going to hold. And, you know, we'll end tonight by looking at this. Just give me a few more minutes. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. Knowing the extremely unlikely chances that life, this is my stuff, that life could come about on this planet the way many evolutionists had hoped, eminent scientists like Fred Hoyle, Francis Crick, who I cited, Carl Sagan, believed that it had to start elsewhere and come from outer space. And the complexity of the cell is known to be yet more wondrous than these men actually knew during their lifetimes. They found out even more stuff since then. Any of you seen Exposed? No intelligence allowed? Expelled. You should see it, Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. At the end there, they interview Richard Dawkins. And say, well, where did life come from? He says, I don't know. But maybe it was seeded from outer space. Aliens. Anything but God, dude. Anything but God. You know? We're the ones who are supposed to believe in Santa Claus and the flying spaghetti monster. They believe in aliens. Of course, we don't believe in Santa Claus and the flying spaghetti monster, but we do believe in a creator, God. Claiming life came from outer space isn't an answer at all, although it might keep the issue of biogenesis off the table for a while longer. That's a law of biology, that life doesn't come from non-life. That's a law. We still have to ask, how did life start some other place in the universe? Out of sight, out of mind is really all that is being done here. Just a rhetorical trick. This rhetorical trick is performed all the time by naturalists and evolutionists. They simply put their imaginations forward as some kind of scientific proof. And because they've got scientific credentials, people listen to them. But all they do is spinning you a yarn. They're not telling you that they found this stuff out. They're telling you what they hypothesize must be the case given their naturalistic predispositions. Therefore, they try to put the burden of proof on someone who says, well, how did this happen? And they say, I'm not sure, but I can imagine it happened this way. If they can imagine it happened that way, then it could have happened that way, couldn't it? Is that how the world works for you? If I imagine that something, if I imagine this woman loves me, will she love me? If I imagine that I'm a rich person, will I automatically become a rich person? That's not how the world works. What if the Miller-Urey experiment, that failed experiment to produce amino acids, or Aveda, which is one of these programs, you know, that they use to supposedly duplicate how life came about, and of course they have to feed it information and a goal as well in order for it to work. They don't tell you that. Stephen Mayer has said about these information-fed extrapolations, quote, since the law-like processes of necessity do not generate new information, these combinatorial models invariably rely upon chance events to do most, if not all, the work of producing new information. This problem arises repeatedly for models invoking prebiotic natural selection in conjunction with random events, whether Oparin's theories or various RNA world scenarios. Since natural selection selects for functional advantage, and since functional advantage ensues only after the result of a successful random search for functional information, sorry about this jargon, combination models invariably rely upon chance rather than selection to produce new information. Yet these theories face formidable probabilistic hurdles, just as pre-chance models do. That's in his book, Signature in the Cell, there. Here are some fundamental questions to start with. Quote, or it's not quote, this is me. If the chances of a living cell coming from non-living elements, which themselves came from hydrogen and helium, remember, which are inert gases, are staggeringly small, why would you believe it? Why would you believe something that was so improbable? I mean, that's a question that that should be put to these people. Why would you believe that? One of these guys here, talking about the multiverse, this you know, something happens. We have an infinite amount of multiverses. We just happen to be in the one where there is life and conscience and stuff. And there are universes out there. We can't see them. We can't don't know anything about them. Okay, but there are universes out there where you had oatmeal for breakfast this morning and got up and committed suicide. As well as the universes out there that produce this planet, you see? And people say, why would you believe something like that when you can believe everything was created by God? Isn't that a simpler and more fitting explanation? And certainly believable, as we've been talking about and as we will continue to talk about. Here I'm just dealing with the scientific stuff. All living cells contain DNA, but how did the informational instructions that are incredibly complex, in fact the most complex information and instructions in the known universe are in the DNA molecule, not just on the way that the four letters interact, the code interacts, and it is a code, but also the information is on the spine of the DNA molecule. It's not actually in the helix itself, but runs along the center. And then there's other information that the DNA doesn't contain. But that information is essential to life. All living cells contain DNA, but how did the informational instructions for each of the cell's operations come about? Well, we know how instructions come about every other scenario that we've ever seen. It takes an intelligence. It takes thought. That's the scientific way of doing it, because this is the empirical way of doing it. It's never been done any other way. There are no counterexamples to this. See, as every instance of this kind of instructional information ever known comes from minds, why look for its cause in mindlessness? Why because all amino acids are left-handed, must that mean all life is related to a common ancestor? Why? That's actually a variety of a logical fallacy called the compositional fallacy. In the same vein, and with the same fallacy, why? Because different creatures have features which look similar, this is your orca thing, are they necessarily derived from a common source? You guys, in making your, exhaust system again? You utilize things that are used in other systems to make your system. Do you see? Doesn't mean that that your exhaust system evolved from those systems or the other way around. It just means there's a common designer. These fallacies are built upon the premise that evolution is true, which is a question-begging premise. Do forks and spoons and scissors and whisks have a common ancestor? Of course they don't. Since evolutionists wrongly predicted that there would be much junk DNA, which is exactly what they did predict, and creationists rightly predicted there wouldn't, why label evolution science and creationism religion? When they sent these probes out to the different planets, you know, Voyager and all of these others, you know, every single prediction of NASA about the planets was wrong. Every single one. And the moons. They didn't get one right. they said Mercury would just be kind of a hot, dead rock with no core. Well, it's got a core. It's got magnetism. It's got an atmosphere. They predicted it wouldn't have. According to their model, Jupiter actually shouldn't be there where it is, but there it is. They projected that Pluto would have tons and tons and tons and tons of just impact craters all over it, but it's smooth. All kinds of things that they predicted, and they're wrong. And some creation scientists actually did predict on a creation model what they would find, and that's what they found. Russell Humphreys being one of those people. So who's doing science and who's doing pseudoscience? Just because you have the money and the technology to send these things there, by the way, I understand scientists say this is what we want and this is what we need, but it's other people that build this stuff. You know, the engineers and so on build this stuff. I had a good friend who was an engineer who worked at the CERN atom smasher in Switzerland. And his job, he was a computational engineer. He was the one that set up the parameters of the different things according to what the top scientists needed. He did the work. He was not himself a scientist, but he did what they needed to be done. So don't think it's just science that's doing this, you see? It's people that know how to build stuff and design stuff that are doing it too. That's why they can send rockets to Mars and so on. Since evolutionists wrongly predict... Oh, sorry, I've done that one. How long is it going to be until evolutionists admit that the fossil record, which is the sole source for determining the truth or falsity of evolutionary history, undermines the whole theory? Which it does. What you find in the fossil record, and they've known this for years and years and years, what you find is that things appear quickly in the fossil record. They live for a certain amount of time. They say millions of years, of course. But they live and then they disappear. And there's no change. You do find diversity, like in dogs and cats and stuff, diversity within that, what we might call a kind or a species. But you don't find anything changing into something else. So what that tells you is that within the design, there is an ability within certain parameters to change into, you know, a cat into a lion or a tiger or something like that, but it's not going to change into a bear. But there are certain parameters it won't go beyond. That's the kind of evolution, it's called microevolution, that everyone believes in. It's not a problem. But this stuff where there's just one tree isn't true at all. Everything came from one thing and it's just branching out into one tree. There's no evidence for that in the fossil record at all. What you find are trees. The tree for cats, the tree for bears, the tree for horses, the tree for dogs. It's what you find. All right, we'll stop there for 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Sure. Any questions just for those of you that just want to ask a question quickly?
How do you respond to... stars and light years it takes for light little stars to get here. How do you explain these relatively new Earth?
In Genesis chapter 1, you find that verses 10, 11, and 12, you find, I think it's the third day, you find grasses and herbs made. Okay? Let the earth bring these forth. It had 24 hours to bring them forth. It says in Genesis chapter 2 that in the Garden of Eden, God planted trees. Okay? Didn't say they grew up over 100 years. They were just there. Do you see? And so, just kind of like a stop motion picture or thing, you know, where it's speeded up. That's probably what happened in day 3. And so day 4, which is the creation of the, like the stars. Remember, why were they created? To give, not necessarily to give light, although they were created to give guidance. How could they give guidance if they took millions of years for the light to get here? Okay, so automatically, if that's what they were built for, then the light would have to have been there on day four. Well, if he can create stars, can't he get the light from the star to where he wants it to be? Of course he can, you see. It all depends on your worldview.
Right.
And of course the anthropic principle and so on has shown that the stars and the way that the stars are, they actually have an impact on the constants that are necessary for life to be on this earth. So there's an interplay between the planets and the stars and all of these other things with this earth. That's the anthropic principle. They hate it. Evolutionists hate it. They hate this cosmic fine-tuning stuff.
Yeah, I think we saw that conference we went to one time, they explaining the time, the shifts of time, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. And of course, you were asked last week to go and, because there's an eclipse coming up, so I asked you to find out something about a solar eclipse. What did you find out that was really interesting?
Shadow snakes.
What's that?
Shadow snakes.
Yeah.
My favorite thing is all like the stuff was always like, oh, it's such a great coincidence that the moon happens to be in the right spot.
It's such a coincidence that it is.
Yeah, that's a real good coincidence.
What is it? It's 400 times smaller than the sun in circumference. But it's 400 times, is it further away or something like that, the distance that it's needed. So it's in exactly the right spot for to cover the sun, but not completely obliterate the sun because the corona can be seen. And through observing the corona, scientists have been able to find out about stars. It's almost like it was designed for us to do that experiment. Do you see?
Interesting. The elliptical courses, the planets and the sun.
Yes.
People say, why don't we see an eclipse more often? Because their orbits are elliptical.
Yeah, elliptical, yes. Yes, that's right. And there's no other month. Moon on any planet that's anywhere like that can do that. Also, by the way, you may have heard that, again, they like to downplay Earth. They like to downplay how special we are. They say this sun is just an insignificant sun, just a small sun. No, it's not. It's 70% bigger than any sun that we know, any star that we know. But it's exactly the right size for this Earth. Okay, now, it's many, many times smaller than some of the huge super giants, okay, the red giants and so on. But most of the stars that we see and that they've figured out how big they are, most of them are a lot smaller and a lot colder than our sun. So don't fall again for what these scientists say. This is an insignificant sun in an insignificant... No, it's not. They know that, by the way. But you see, they're not trying to teach you science. They're trying to teach you their worldview. They're trying to teach you their atheism. That's what they're trying to teach you. Let's continue then, looking at some of these things. So this book, Undeniable, by Douglas Axe, has just come out. And this is a great book for you it does get a little bit complex, but most of it is really easily understood. I think it's his, near the beginning of his book anyway, page 16, he has a subheading called starting with the soup, or starting with soup. And he says this. A team of researchers in the culinary sciences recently discovered a revolutionary new soup they call Oracle Soup, referring to the oracles, that is, mysterious revelations, the ancient Greeks sought from their gods. Indeed, had this soup been known in the days of Homer, it surely would have been attributed to a powerful god. It looks just like alphabet soup, thin broth with little pasta letters and numbers swirling around, but this soup of the gods distinguishes itself by what it does, as this experimental recipe shows. 1. Fill a large pot with oracle soup. 2. Cover the pot and bring the soup to a boil. 3. Remove the pot from the heat and let the soup cool. 4. Lift the lid to reveal complete instructions for building something new and useful, worthy of a patent, all spelled out in pasta letters. 5. Repeat from step 2 as often as desired. You don't believe a word of this, of course, and that's precisely my point. This is actually a storytelling experiment instead of a kitchen experiment. You were my experimental subject, but now I want you to examine the result. What did you observe? Well, in the space of a moment or two, you decided with complete confidence that Oracle Soup can't be real. You and everyone else who reads the account. What his point is in this book is that he's saying you can identify something that's designed from something that's not, and it's intuitional. You just do it. It's intuitional. And his book is dealing with that intuition. Okay? Now, later on, he's going to talk about some of the math behind it, and I'll get into some of that. Not that I'm a mathematician, I'm just going to quote stuff. But later on he quotes Neil deGrasse Tyson, and the first episode of Cosmos, a space-time odyssey television series, Tyson said this, quote, "This adventure is made possible by generations of searchers strictly adhering to a simple set of rules. Test ideas by experiment and observation, build on those ideas that pass the test, reject the ones that fail, follow the evidence wherever it leads, and question everything. Accept these terms, and the cosmos is yours." Sounds kind of like that claptrap I was reading at the beginning of the lesson, doesn't it? This is how scientists present themselves. They're just doing objective science. And people swallow this. So the other day I was at Hammond Hospital visiting somebody, and I took a picture of a bumper sticker. Instead of a fish, it was a rocket ship with science on it. Their faith was in science. If they knew how unscientific a lot of scientists are, if they hadn't swallowed the propaganda that they're fed, they wouldn't have that. But their faith, you see, is in something as ridiculous and fallible as science. Because it's presented in terms like this. And Axe says, that all sounds very nice. And if ideas could be tested with a meter, the way batteries and fuses can, then Tyson's simple rules would work. But you see, that's not a scientific statement. He's trying to talk about the scientific method, which, by the way, was invented by Christians in the Middle Ages, Robert Grosseteste and Roger Bacon, and then refined by Francis Bacon, and so on. But the scientific method is not just this robotic method. I mean, the people that are using the method, they have a certain worldview that they are using it against. And this lie, and that's just what it is, that follow the evidence wherever it leads, they're not inclined to do that at all unless it comes to naturalistic, atheistic conclusions. Then they'll follow it, which, of course, the evidence doesn't. Never does. It never does. They have to tell a story in order to make it do that. The mathematics on this is staggering. This is on DNA and so on. Michael Denton is not a Christian. He wrote this book. Where is it? Evolution, Theory in Crisis. This is his the new book, still a theory in crisis. It's written 25 years later. This is somewhat of a difficult book to read. And he has something about homology that I might get to in a minute. But he's not a Christian. Okay? He doesn't believe in God, and he doesn't believe in creationism. But he doesn't believe in the present neo-Darwinistic view of evolution either. He says it's nonsensical. Writing about the possibility of life starting by chance, he says, quote, as it can easily be shown that no more than 10 to the power of 40 possible proteins, you know what that is, 10 with 40 zeros after it, could ever have existed on Earth since its formation. And by the way, Denton believes that the Earth is billions of years old. This means that if protein functions reside in sequences any less probable than 10 to the power of minus 40, it becomes increasingly unlikely that any functional proteins could ever have been discovered by chance on Earth. To get a cell by chance would require at least 100 functional proteins to appear simultaneously in one place. Proteins are extremely complex. That is 100 simultaneous events, each of an independent probability, not relying on each other, which could hardly be more than 10 to the power of 20, giving a maximum combined probability of 10 to the power of 2,000. Evolutionists have got to take the odds, although they often subtract important data to reduce the number. Denton continues, recently Hoyle and Rick Ramasinghe in Evolution from Space provided a similar estimate of the chance of life originating, assuming functional proteins have a probability of 10 to the power of, it says, minus 20. By itself, he quotes them, this small probability could be faced because one must contemplate not just a single shot at obtaining the enzyme, but a very large number of trials, such as are supposed to have occurred in an organic soup early in the history of the Earth. The trouble is that there are about 2,000 enzymes. We've actually found more than that now. And the chance of obtaining them all in a random trial is only one part in 10 to the power of 20 to the power of 2,000. That is 10 to the power of 40,000. An outrageously small probability that could not be faced even if the whole universe consisted of an organic soup. End quote. These numbers are closer to nil than quarks and mesons are to nothing. When you are getting this kind of figure, when you think that 10 to the power of 40 possible proteins ever existed, and yet the chances of life originating by chance is 10 to the power of 40,000, you need to give it up. We are way past Disneyland imagination here. We're in cuckoo land. Again, quote, the probability that even one of these information-rich molecules arose by chance, let alone the suite of such molecules necessary to maintain or build a minimally complex cell, is so small as to dwarf the probabilistic resources of the entire universe. That's Stephen Meyer, Signature of the Cell, page 222. Evolution couldn't get going. The mechanism of evolution is natural selection, but that cannot be part of the equation at this critical juncture. Why? Because natural selection only selects from what's there. And it can't select from what's not there. According to Hazen and Trefill in the book Science Matters, the first stage chemical evolution, quote, encompasses the origin of life from non-life. We have every right to say, no, it doesn't. And when we have the National Association of Biology Teachers in the USA writing such things as, quote, "The diversity of life on Earth is the outcome of evolution, an unpredictable and natural process of temporal descent with genetic modification that is affected by natural selection, chance, historical contingencies, and changing environments," we have a right to ask if that is what the fossil evidence demonstrates. Excuse me. And it doesn't. It demonstrates the exact opposite. So Axe has actually done a whole bunch of experiments on protein folds. He's known as an expert on protein folds. And I don't know whether you know this, but every protein is folded in a certain way so that it will do a certain function. In other words, the information for it to do what it does is in the fold, is in the way that it's folded, like origami and stuff, yes? Of course, the information to fold it comes from outside. And these folds are extremely improbable. And so he's done works on that, and he has found what he calls functional coherence in all of these proteins and all of these enzymes. Page 180 and following. "Just how exquisite are the arrangements of amino acids that cause protein chains to fold? This is what I set out to measure with the experimental project I described at the start of chapter 5. My aim in that work was to measure how improbable functional coherence is this." Okay? You design something together, you know, so that you know all the different parts are going to fit together and make the thing work. Is for these amino acids in much the same way we assess this for letters and pixels in chapter 9. And then he talks about his procedure. And then he said this: "Once this was determined experimentally for the four clusters shown," which he illustrates, "the next step was to calculate the improbability of evolution stumbling upon that minimal functional coherence, not just in those four clusters, but in all the clusters needed for the protein to fold. I did this by converting the fraction of mutants that worked in each of the four experiments into an average probability of functional coherence per amino acid. I then multiplied this to estimate the likelihood of a fully randomized gene having the functional coherence needed to form a structure that supports enzyme function. As I said at the beginning of chapter 5, the result was striking. Of the possible genes encoding protein chains 153 amino acids in length, only about 1 in 100 trillion, 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 trillion is expected to encode a chain that folds well enough to perform a biological function." This is ridiculous, folks, believing that, you know, they say we've got faith. This is ridiculous. I don't believe that stuff. That's rubbish. Nobody should believe that stuff. Nobody should believe that stuff. And yet these scientists do. Why do they do it? Because the scientist compels them to do it? He's doing the experiments. Why? I gave you the answer at the beginning of the class. The only game in town is naturalism. There have to be natural answers, naturalistic answers, non-purposeful answers. We cannot bring intelligence in, we cannot bring God in, we cannot bring purpose in. It's not allowed. So what do they do? Well, we don't know right now, but they use what's called an eschatological cop-out. We'll find out in the future. But you see, the trouble is, the more time passes, the more complex things are getting. The more we're finding out how difficult it is to explain these things. So they're getting themselves more and more into the oracle soup. I'll just finish this quotation quickly, because he goes on. He says, "So as hard as it was for our noise-seeking robot in Chapter 7 to find a stadium, finding a biological invention is much harder, even at the low level of a single protein. We estimated that stadium noise may cover one part of 100,000 of the Earth's surface, but the result here paints a much bleaker picture. Instead of the Earth's surface for a search space, try picturing a sphere the size of the visible universe, 28 billion light years in diameter, and instead of a target that covers 6,000 square kilometers, try picturing one the size of a hydrogen atom. Now that's a target we can safely write off as lost in space." That's the probability that these protein folds, to make one single protein, that's the probability of one of these being made by naturalistic causes. They weren't made by naturalistic causes. They're made by God. They were designed by God to do this. And these proteins, by the way, what they can do in their folds and their shape is certain of them, when they're a disease or something comes into the body, they can change shape. They can actually replicate this new thing to get something to fight it, and then once it's fought and gotten rid of, they change back again to their original shape. How do you do that? How do you explain that unless it's designed? We know that, I don't know anything about computers, and I'm always messing up on them, but I do know enough to put something that's important into a file, okay? So the information's there, but I can put it into a file, and then sometimes I can put that file into another file, you see? And then sometimes, if I'm adventurous, I'll put that file into another file, do you see? And some people are so confident and organized that they can put that into still more files. That's what you find in the cell. You know, they file this information away in another file, and then that into another file, and that into another file. So you have levels of information. Well, I know that the computer, you know, and the ability to file things like that, that didn't come about by blind chance. There's only one explanation for that that's ever been known that could do that, and that is mind. The Bible declares that people are guilty, when they look at the universe, when they look at themselves, when they look at the marvels all around them, for not ascribing glory to God for it. The evidence, you know, Bertrand Russell, just, you know, show me the evidence and so on. The evidence is all around them. But if you don't want to see something, you won't see it. And by the way, we know that ourselves. We don't want to appear or admit to each other that we've done that. That there's something maybe about somebody we like that we ignored. Okay? Because we don't want to hear it. Something about ourselves that somebody who is maybe our bosses and so on, they've told us something about ourselves that we've observed. We don't want to listen to it. We don't want to believe that about ourselves. We've seen that when we've told our kids. It's something that we're seeing. They don't want to hear it. Well, they're culpable. You're culpable. People are culpable for not seeing what's right in front of them. Every cell contains at least 10, and I've not, million bits of information. What's that? Something 2 trillion? 10 trillion, trillion, something like that. It contains the whole code needed to build the organism of which it is a part. It contains factories and distribution systems which make 2,000 proteins. How long does it take to make 2,000 proteins? Thinking about how complex proteins are. How long? Every second. Every second. It would take, at time of writing, a supercomputer 10 to the 127th power years to achieve what real proteins do in seconds in terms of generation. And we are supposed to believe that matter and motion and the laws of physics evolved it. The onset of the computer age has put information on the map as a third aspect of reality which must be contended with. A worldview that ignores the science of information or that cannot account for information at the most rudimentary level of existence is not a coherent account of the world. Indeed, Bruce Alberts, former president of the National Academy of Sciences, has said that scientists will have to take design courses in order for them to help comprehend what is being uncovered. Everyone knows that matter is the main vehicle for information, but as Varghese rightly asks, how did it become a vehicle for codes and blueprints? We know it takes intelligence to decode the information transmitted by matter. But if decoding requires intelligence, how about encoding? If information exists prior to matter, what is its source? Professor Werner Gitt, former head of the Department of Information Technology at the German Federal Institute of Physics and Technology, has said, quote, information originates as a language. It is first formulated and then transmitted or stored. And he's set up a whole bunch of theorems in his book, In the Beginning Was Information. Theorem 23 is, there is no known natural law through which matter can give rise to information. Neither is any physical process or material phenomenon known that can do this. And it just goes on and on. I could quote you a lot more, but what do you do then with all of this stuff? Well, what you do is that you stop it being taught. If materialism is true because it's got to be true, okay, if that's the case, then anything that is going to cause people to question that and think, well, hold on a minute, that's not, how can that be true? Anything that's going to cast doubt on this paradigm, what these scientists want people to believe, and they get very annoyed, by the way, at these polls when the American public say that they believe in God or a God, and they don't believe in evolution, is just not going to be taught. It's not going to be taught by the scientists who put pressure on the courts. It's not going to be taught by the academy. It's not going to be taught by the professors, because remember, the professors are only allowed to be professors if they agree with the reigning paradigm. It's not going to be taught by the teachers who those professors teach. And it's not going to be taught to your kids. They're not going to find it on TV, and because there's just an open forum, you don't have to examine these books. You can just call them all creationists. You know, that bad word. And just say they're not doing science. And that's enough. You just, with a wave of the hand, you just dismiss it. And get down to lying to yourself and everybody else that naturalism must be true. That's culpable ignorance. And it's not scientists are following the facts wherever they lead. They are not doing that. They're not interested in doing that. They're only interested in defending their personal worldview. They're not objective at all. And by the way, neither are you. Neither am I. I believe that God created the universe. I believe that he's sustaining it right now, that Jesus Christ is sustaining the universe right now. I believe that I'm a sinner. They don't. David Berlinski, who's this book, by the way, if you want a fun read, The Deniable Darwin by David Berlinski, he's an agnostic. He's not. He's a mathematician and he's a chemist. So he's not a creationist at all. He says the real infirmities of Darwin's theory are conceptual and not empirical. By the standards of serious sciences, Darwin's theory of evolution remains little more than a collection of anecdotal remarks. And he's right. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. Don't believe their view that the universe is billions of years old or the world is billions of years old. We haven't gone into all of the evidence about a young Earth, but there's plenty of evidence for a young Earth. Or the evidence for a flood. But I can say this, that Mars has got huge canyons on it. Huge canyons. Bigger than the Grand Canyon. Guess what the scientists, the cosmologists, believe made those canyons? Water. They do. They believe that water created those canyons, carved it out as it was receding. Okay? Is there any water on Mars? What about the Grand Canyon? How do they say the Grand Canyon was made? By a little bit of water, the Colorado River. Okay? They're saying that some kind of global flood created those huge canyons on Mars. Okay? And then they say, but there was no global flood that created the canyons and stuff, all different topographical regions of the Earth, on Earth. And they even ask this question, where's all the water from the flood? Where do you think it is? I'm not sure. I mean, where could it be? Where could the water from the flood be? Have you ever seen a globe? There's more water on the ground, I believe, than there is actually in the seas. But about 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by water. There are nearly, well, every ancient civilization has a flood story. The Eskimos do. Do you think they got that from the Bible? The Incas do. The Mesopotamians, the Chinese. In the Chinese, I used to teach at a Chinese church in Arlington, Texas. I don't know Chinese, no. But I asked them, I said, look, what's the Chinese symbol? Because they're pictographs, okay? They use pictographs, pictures. What's the Chinese symbol for a big boat, a ship? Okay? And it's the symbol for boat and then the symbol for eight. Well, there were how many people came off the ark? That was a big boat, wasn't it? Very ancient language. So the evidence is there, folks, but you're not allowed to teach it. The only place that you will have it taught you is a place like this. I understand, in closing, that this lesson where I'm quoting a bunch of stuff and just throwing a bunch of stuff at you, and I could have thrown a whole bunch more at you, is kind of difficult, particularly for you guys that came, you know, this is your first time. So that's kind of difficult. But this is the third of my explorations into science and naturalism. In the first two, I was talking about how we know, and I was talking about
how naturalism as a philosophy is just incoherent. It doesn't work. And how the Christian worldview works and explains and does present you with the world that we have. But according to the Bible, there are things at work in the human heart that stop us accepting the truth unless the grace of God comes to us and we are convicted of our sins and receive the truth. And that is that we want to be independent from God. We do right now, by the way, even as Christians, we want to be independent from God. That's our default setting. That's why it's difficult to do the right thing. That's why it's easy to do the wrong thing. It's easy to drift from God. You have to put some effort in if you want to be close to God. Your default setting is the same as Eve before the tree. Okay, I'm going to agree with God that it's pleasant for the eyes. I'm going to agree with God that it's good for food. This is me independently arbitrating where God's right and where he's not. And then I'm also going to add something from myself. It's there to make one wise. And I'm going to decide who to believe. That's what we do. And unsaved people do that, but to a degree even more. They just do not want to believe in God. My last quotation, it's just a re-quotation of Richard Lewontin. Harvard geneticist says this: we take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but, on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations. No matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated, moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door.